Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
So, Guy, Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets.
You did. And in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy.
It's been a while.
It's been a while, but so we've compiled, or we haven't. We haven't been sitting here with
we've done nothing. We've done nothing, Gary.
We've had our feet up on a sun lounger somewhere, haven't we?
I wish.
Not together, by the way, I have to say. We don't share a sun lounger, do we?
We do. I like that. I think our listeners should imagine us as this sort of Morecambe and Wise couple.
Holidaying in Eastbourne.
Yeah, exactly. Staying in Mrs. Muggins' B&B, sharing a bed.
With a record player and a few vinyl records we've taken
down.
Exactly,
with a dance set. Exactly. And then just scouring the local flea markets.
Yeah.
For a kind of rare stack ridge.
So our lovely producer, Ian, has compiled a few episodes, which we're going to be playing, you'll be able to get over the next few weeks.
Yeah, to fill in. And we're starting off with Guitar Heroes.
Yeah, we are. And we're going to have a few clips from the various Guitar Heroes that we've had on. Who are we going to be listening to today?
We've got Mike Campbell from Tom Petty and Fleetwood Mac, Joan Armour Trading, Johnny Marr, Nile Rodgers, and Phil Manzanera.
Phil Manzanera, yeah, good friend of yours, yeah.
I had the most amazing, sorry, the one little tidbit I do want to put in was the other week I had the incredible honour of playing in a supergroup at John Wetton's memorial. And all three of them were alumni of Rockonteurs. It was Phil Manzanera, Chris Difford, and the man who hasn't played drums for 20 years, Bill Bruford.
And you played with Bill, didn't you?
We played Let's Stick Together.
Wow. I mean, people have been freaking out about that on the internet, saying, you know, about time, this is something we've always wanted. You know, Guy Pratt and Bill Bruford rhythm section. I don't remember anybody ever wanting that.
Yeah, said no one ever. No, one person did say it. Like, someone said, wow, in all of my fantasy band lineups, I never had kind of Guy Pratt and Bill Bruford on my bingo card.
I don't. How was he to play with?
He was amazing. I mean, we were playing Let's Stick Together. I mean, which was pretty, you know.
Not really Bill Bruford, is it, really?
I mean, but he was so happy. I know. It was so, well, apparently he's, you know, he's always said, I've actually got lots of 4/4 in me. In fact, at the end of the song, Chris did say, "said thank you very much. That's the only song in 4/4 you're going to hear tonight."
Oh, that's brilliant, brilliant.
No, he was brilliant because he was so happy. He was just so happy behind the kit. You can see it if you know, there's clips on YouTube, obviously.
We've got our first rock guitar hero coming up, and it's going to be Scott Gorham, the Californian golden guitar god. And we are going to be picking up at the point where Scott has turned down the chance to work with Supertramp, and instead he's auditioning for some unknown band called Thin Lizzy.
Welcome to the Rockonteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune, for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found
Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
It was great. I'm Phil, you know, I'm the singer. I went, no shit, man. Oh, amazing. And he had this big, huge grin on his face. And he said, come on in. Let me introduce you to the other guys. Like, and, you know, we walk in and I see both the two Brians, arms are crossed, and they're looking at me going, oh, God.
Because Brian Robinson's already got the gig, right?
Oh, yeah. He's been there. He's a veteran. He's been there for 2 weeks, you know. So I go on to meet these guys and I can't understand why they're so standoffish, right? You know, what's the deal here? You know, apparently what had happened is I was guitar player number 25 to come in and audition for the band. And all they thought was, well, here's another one we're going to hate. We're just going to kick them out in the street, you know? Actually, I got through the audition.
What was the audition?
You know, I should know that.
Breakfast in America.
Yeah, dreamer.
Right? Oh, my God. I actually know that one. Some of it was just the three chord blues kind of thing. Right. And I remember at one point, Phil turns around to Robbo and says, hey, teach Scott such and such, right? So he blitzes through it really quickly, and I'm desperately trying to, you know, catch the chord patterns. And he says, you got it? I went, well, he goes, let me go through it again. He goes, bang, 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 bang. And then we take a break. And then the middle eight, it's kind of, you got it now? Yeah. Okay. And my eyes did not come off of his fretboard for the next 4 minutes, right? He would make a chord change. Bam. I was right behind him. Bam. Right behind him again. Right. So, I think maybe that might have impressed him that I could fake it so well.
But this isn't pub rock, though, because what they're doing is something a little bit different, isn't it? This, I mean, obviously, we all know what Thin Lizzy went on to inspire. You know, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, Def Leppard, everybody. You know, we all wanted to be Thin Lizzy at one point. But where were they getting their ideas from? Where was Phil getting his ideas from?
Well, he loved Van Morrison. There's no doubt about that. He loved the lyrics, the phrasing, the way he sang everything. He was also a massive Jimi Hendrix fan. Jeff Beck, which, well, that's really terrible, isn't it? The word.
Yeah.
He was a huge guitar fan. Phil was, right. The reason he got two guitar players in the band was when Eric Bell quit halfway through. Like this Christmas show. So Phil being the guy he is, said, nope, we're going to carry on. And which is, I think it was the first drums and bass thing that ever happened, right? Because they just kept on going. And he said to himself, that's never going to happen again. If one of the guitar players falls out, I still have another one and we can keep carrying on.
That's why there were two guitar players in case one quits on stage.
At the time, that was a main... Yeah.
You're saying because he loved guitar and he clearly did things like Warrior is and what's funny is when you realize that Warrior is written about Jimi Hendrix, it's the track is so Hendrix.
It's on a different meaning, right?
Yeah, no, but all the riffs are so Hendrix. Oh, right. You know, I'd never really clocked that before. But why did he play bass, do you think? Especially as he's going to sing, I've learned those songs. Singing and playing those parts is not easy.
No. And that's why he loved to pedal that E, right?
Yeah,
That E, right? And when I would come to him and say, Phil, I got this really great riff that we can play in this song, and he'd look at me and go, right? He says, you do know I have to sing over all this, right? And I'm like, yeah, okay. And then we'd have to simplify it down because he figured his main job really was to communicate with the audience, yeah. right? Not to show off what a fabulous bass player he was. And actually, he was a pretty damn good bass
player. He was a great bass player.
I mean, and you could say this.
He was a brilliant bass player.
You could say the same thing
about
Sting.
But he wouldn't tell anybody that.
Sting.
Yeah. He would always put himself down as a bass player.
But, you know, Sting and Paul McCartney, both who sing and play bass, you know, they're both incredible bass players. But they put their performance first, don't they? And it's...
Yes.
So it's not like a guitar player who sings, who goes from singing to guitar to singing to guitar, you know.
Well, I think a lot of people don't realise, and I'm telling you as a bass player who has to sing sometimes, is that there's a really weird thing. Singing and playing guitar is completely intuitive. It makes, and even if it's the same part, there's something about bass playing that's completely different. You have to learn all of it.
Yeah, because you're always on the move.
Yeah.
That's true.
Bass players are always on the move.
We can play a chord.
They're the guys that are keeping it down for you, right? Yeah. Keeping you in line, right? Or the guitar player can hit a chord and have a cigarette at the same time, you know, kind of thing. You know, you can take a break. You know, the bass player and drummer, they can't take a break. You know, they're always working. You know, I'm a true believer. Like I say, in the whole rhythm section, I'm right there with you, man.
When did you and Robbo discover that twin guitar harmony thing, which became such a trademark for you and has gone on? You know, every band has copied it.
It was kind of straight off the bat, only because the songs in the beginning kind of demanded it, but it was very sparse, the harmony guitar. I think the time that it really hit home was, I think it was on the Fighting album, and Robbo went out into the studio just to record a single line, and I think he was going to double track himself, right? Press the record button, he starts to play it, but the engineer had it, he had a delay on it, right? There was a certain amount of delay that when it fed back in harmony, right? Huh? And of course, the engineer was horrified. He's going, oh my God, I'm so sorry about that. I forgot all about that. And I'm going, no, wait a minute. That was really cool. You know, that was not supposed to be a harmony line at all. And that kind of made me realize that we could actually start introducing all these harmony lines in a lot more places than I had realized that we could, right? So that's exactly what we started to do. I even said on the next line, I said, you know, I've got a line here. And I brought Rob over and said, this is the line. You want to work out the harmony to that? And he did. And that was us kind of up and away, you know, on the harmony.
You know what?
Harmony.
I heard you on another podcast, Scott, and you were saying how, but then when Gary Moore came in, that kind of went up a gear again. And then, you know, some of the
exponentially, exponentially, right?
Because I think
there you go. How about we do this?
Because that's it. You just
harmony. I'm like, sure. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea, right?
Did you ever feel threatened by the other guitarist, you know? Was there ever a moment of like, shit, you know, I've got to up my game here, or he might...
Oh, that was constant. I got to up my game. Oh, that was a constant thing, but...
or conversely, was it like, oh, it's this guy, phew, I can relax.
Yeah. Thank God we got him in the band. No, to me, being at Thin Lizzy was, and I hate to use this word, but it was a constant learning journey for me. After having so little playing experience coming in from Glendale, I was constantly learning from everybody that got up on stage with us, right? So for me, it was like a masterclass, you know, being up on the stage with some of these guys, right? And you learn how to steal, but steal in the correct way that nobody knows you're doing it, you know? Right, and applying it to your own style, kind of thing. You're learning the whole time.
Go on.
I always say to everybody, never feel threatened when you come up against somebody who you know is better than you, or you feel that is better than you. What you got to do? You have to learn from these people, you know, because if you don't, you're a fool.
But wouldn't you say that there's, I mean, not unique amongst instruments, but because of where it is, that lead guitarists are by their nature competitive.
Well,
you know,
Yeah.
There is ego there, absolutely. Oh, hey, check this out. Can you do that? You
know? And there aren't many bands with two lead guitarists. I mean, I suppose there's Blue Oyster Cult have three, I suppose, but you know, there aren't many. I got a text from Midgeur today talking about you. And his quote is, "The rock that held it all together. The one guitarist who stood the test of time."
Ah, that's sweet.
Because he played with Midge. Yeah. Midge played in Thin Lizzy.
Midge is great. He's really great. When Gary absconded during halfway through an American tour, Phil says, "Let's get Midge in, right?" And I went, "What? He's a keyboard player, for God's sake." He goes, No, he plays guitar too, and he plays really well. You know, I went, "Does he know the songs?" Yeah, and he didn't, right? So what we did is we got him and said, "Okay, here's your plane ticket." And Mitch is thinking the whole time, "Well, you know, it's an 8-hour flight. I've got my cassette player. I get the headphones on, make a bunch of notes, and, you know, learn a lot of the things that he didn't quite know before," right? But he didn't realize that we'd put him on Concord, and he was brilliant. He was in New York in 3 hours, right? Oops. But as soon as he got into town, I think the first show we did was New Orleans, and I went straight up to his hotel room with my guitar, and we just furiously started. Yeah, beat him to death, right? But, you know, we started where, okay, you do that part, that's your harmony lines that, blah, blah, blah. We just kind of map things out, you know, really quickly. And I said, honestly, if there's a bit that you don't know or you've forgotten, just hang out and just play the chords, and then we'll work on it tomorrow, right? And that's how we worked it. And he did great.
We're going to keep it American. Now we're moving down to Florida. And he had his own band. Has his own band, the Dirty Knobs.
I can never say that. I can never say that name. It's just... does that translate
that's
in
why
America?
I said it.
Does it translate in America? I know.
The Dirty Knobs, I know. Does it mean an amp? A Greek sort of an amp that hasn't been well tended?
You just think of a clinic somewhere in Praed Street, don't you? Paddington. yeah, go on, carry on.
What is it that's so inherently sleazy about Paddington?
Paddington, yes.
They're just, isn't it? Anything that happens in Paddington is...
It is. It's a sort of where Graham Greene's characters...
Dirty Mac, isn't it?
...wander when they're feeling like they need to meet Mitzi. Yes, he was obviously Tom Petty's right-hand man and co-wrote the brilliant Boys of Summer with Don Henley, which... I never fully knew until, you know, researching Mike and having Mike come on the show. And I remember it being, it was a great show and some great stories in there. So let's get him on, Mike Campbell. Now we're in that, talking about Boys of Summer and Don Henley. And how did it develop? Did you have all of the chord structure?
Yeah, it's definitely worth lighting a pipe for. Definitely worth lighting a pipe for, loving the pipe.
Oh, it's tobacco. It's tobacco. It's tobacco.
Okay.
But it's my last vice. I've given up all the other stuff. Well, I'll tell you quickly. It's, you know, it's a songwriting experience that I had. I had the Linn drum, and I was basically playing around with it. And I got all those little tick, 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 you know, little bits. And And I was making a beat. And then I happened to have a synthesizer there in my room that day. I had the beat. I was just going da-da-da-da-da along with that and came up with the chords on the keyboard. And under my TAC 4 track, you know, I put the drums on one track and the keyboard on another and put a few guitars on it and threw the chords together like I always do when I write. You know, I just kind of put something together that I thought, you know, had a feel and an arc to it. And I was just really lucky with that one. You know, Don heard it and immediately, you know, got a song in his head.
Did you write it for Tom initially? Did you think it was
for
him?
Everything I write is basically for me. But of course, with Tom, I would always show him everything I did. And I showed him that song, him and Jimmy Iovine, during whatever record we were working on, Southern Accents. And I had the demo, and I played it for him, and they kind of liked it. But in Tom's defense, at the time I played it for him, I had a different chorus chord. I went to a minor chord in the chorus. Mm. And as the summer was finished, it goes to a major chord in the chorus, which lifts it up.
Yeah, that would have been Boys of Winter.
Yes, he didn't really hear it the way Don heard it.
Yeah.
Or he may have kept it. But it really wasn't in the flow of the thing we were doing at the time. And so Iovine told me that Don was looking for some music. I figured, well, that's been overlooked. I'll send this to him. And, you know, I'm just, I'm always seem to be in the right place at the right time, you know. I don't know how.
But I was watching you talk about it on your Instagram site, and you were in the room, weren't you, when you played it to Don?
Yeah. I'd never met him before. And
oh, wow. So it's not like you knew him or something?
No. Jimmy Iovine phone call. And I went to his house in L.A., up in the mountains, and he had this big breakfast table. He sat at one end like this with his arms crossed and his head down, and he had a little cassette player, and I gave him my cassette. And he didn't move. He didn't tap his foot. He didn't nod his head or anything. I thought he hated it. I'm sitting at the other end of the table just thinking, well, as soon as this is over, I'll get out of here, you know.
Wow. It sounds like a meeting between Macron and Putin, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. I don't know which is which.
Macron. Go for Macron.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Don. he kind of went, yeah, that's, you know, I'll work on that. And I thought, yeah, right. Okay. So I drove home. And then he called me and he said, I've written the best song I've written in 10 years to that track, and I want to make a record out of it. And I guess he took the cassette out in his car and he saw a Deadhead sticker on a Cadillac, and he wrote the words listening to the cassette. And yeah, there's more to the story, but that's the rough idea how it happened.
You know what? I think, you know, we all love what Don added to that and lyrically what he added to it. But the music that you gave him, I think, you know, as a songwriter myself, it led him into the wistful nostalgia that the lyrics were about. I feel that was already, that's in the music. He just drew out what you were already making.
You're right. You're right. There's a, and it's, you know, I'm not going to take full credit for it. It's just a muse, you know. It was a day where I just had those chords, struck a chord in me, and I put the guitar on, and it all seemed to take on this shape of a mood, you know, like a wistful mood. But then with the redemption in the chorus where it goes major key, which really made a difference. And I do think the music is really good on that one. It kind of stands on its own as an instrumental in a way. And I guess when Don heard it, he could feel that, and it inspired him, you know, to come up with what he came up with. So it's a give and take thing.
Just a little bit interested, and I think after talking to you, even for this short amount of time, I can see what a generous guy you are. But I'm just interested to know how it felt to have, you know, you had a writing relationship with Tom, and you were definitely the, you know, the guitar player, right-hand man. And then Jeff comes in, he's another guitar player, and he's writing a lot with Tom. Did that feel like another woman, if you know what I'm saying, Mike?
I know what you're saying. I don't ever remember feeling any kind of jealousy. I was just happy to be in the room, you know, and the stuff was coming in so good. I mean, I did end up getting some co-writes with them, but no, you know, it's like a breath of fresh air for both of us, you know, bring in some new energy. And, you know, it's interesting with Jeff, we would start a track in the afternoon, and by 6 p.m. the record was done. All background vocals, solo, harmonies,
wow,
vocal, he just gets it done. But I found out early in the process that you better have some ideas in your pocket. Because we cut a track one day and we needed to put a guitar on it. So next day we came in and he said, so, well, Mike, have you got any ideas? And I'm used to just, we'll run the tape and I'll fall into something. He said, no, not off the top. He said, well, I do. And he'd been up all night working the guitar part, right? And it was great. So I learned real fast that if I want to get a record, I better just say, yeah, I got something right here. You know? From then on, I had something ready to go, you know. I did my homework.
And that heat is horrible, isn't it? I can imagine what that feels like when all the eyes are on you. I mean, it's a bit like poor George Harrison in the Get Back film, when you can see that Paul isn't happy with what he's playing, but he's just really under pressure because the cameras are on him.
Yeah. George is a wonderful guy. You know, on the song Handle With Care, George liked me for some reason. He just really liked me, and he was real kind to me. They called me down to the session. They hadn't put the slide guitar on Handle With Care yet, and they wanted me to play on it, you know, because they were just generous that way. So I went down there, and, you know, there's Jeff Lynne and George Harrison, who I didn't know that well yet, and I'm pretty intimidated. And I got my amp guitar, and they ran the track, and I was playing, but I was kind of like a little bit frozen up because that's the Beatles sitting there, you know?
Yeah.
And so finally, Jeff said, no, that's pretty good what you did. I said, no, it's not right. I said, what I hear on here is George playing the slide because it's his.
It's George Harrison.
If he plays it, it'd be better than what I'm doing. So he took my guitar with my sound and played that beautiful slide solo. But that's an instance where I was just, you know, intimidated by the presence in the room. It does happen sometimes.
I don't know how much you want to say about that time when, you know, you got the call about Tom and how the band and the Heartbreakers dealt with all of that.
Well, it's how do you deal with the death in the family? I'm still grieving, and I'll probably always grieve, but I'm getting past the hollow, empty grieving into more of a grateful type of grieving where I hear the songs and I think of him. And I have dreams about him sometimes that are beautiful. I have great memories, and I hold on to those. And I always kind of feel like he's sitting next to me in a way because we were so close. And if I'm doing anything and I'm not, well, I don't know what I should do. It's almost like I go, hey, what would you do? And he kind of leads me, you know. It sounds kind of corny, but we were really close, you know. And, you know, it was a mishap that he should still be here, but it was just an accidental thing that happened. And it kind of shook our world quite strongly, you know. And I don't think you ever get over something like that, you know, but you have to carry on.
Yeah.
And keep making music, you know.
Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, someone who's so full of creative juice and life, for them to be taken away so soon is, you know, that's so shocking.
Aside from being in a band, we were brothers, you know, we were really close friends. And I think what I missed the most, I missed the music, but I also just missed the phone calls. You know, we just talk on the phone. And he was so funny and a great conversationalist and very smart. And I really missed those conversations.
Yeah.
So if you want to hear all of Mike Campbell's episode, obviously you can search it somewhere in our archives, which are all up there. How many years have we been doing this, Guy? I don't even know.
742.
Yes, there were three plagues during it, weren't there?
That's right. I remember. Do you remember we had to do that special on the repeal of the Corn Laws?
I just remember when I had to, we're doing it, you were covered in boils.
Yeah, that was only a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, when you finish listening to this Guitar Hero special, you can dig back and hear any of these, obviously.
Exactly. There's something like 160 of them. But anyway, now we're moving up to a homegrown guitar god, S. We chatted quite recently to Joan Armour Trading, who is not only a superb songwriter, an instantly recognisable singer, but, and I can attest to this from having seen her from the side of the stage for a whole tour in Australia, she can shred.
It's such a pleasure to have you on. You know, I mean, you've been in our lives for so long. This is your 50th anniversary, isn't it?
Yeah, you guys aren't doing too bad either, though.
But we were just saying, Joan, how we can both remember exactly the first time and where we were when we heard Love and Affection.
Oh, right.
It was such an incredibly powerful record. I remember I bought that album because of it at the age of 14, 15, when I just, you know, I wasn't buying that sort of thing. It was fantastic.
That's right.
No, it's lovely to hear. I now and again get people from heavy metal bands saying this is the record I bought, and I just heard I can't remember the name of the band, but it's a very heavy metal, you know, that raw thing. They did a cover of one of my songs, Bad Habits, in that rah, 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 you know,
really
that voice when they sound like monsters.
Oh, well, with a lover I could really dance.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh,
yeah. Right.
Yeah, you know what, it's funny with that track, because I bought that as well, and I was buying punk at the time, and I wouldn't have bought Carole King's Tapestry then. That was too much for
you. Should have.
Yeah, I know I should have done, and I did later.
A lot of time.
But there was, you know, the singer-songwriter wasn't really in my world, you know. But that record, for some reason, seemed to cross over. It had, and I think it's something to do with your voice, something to do with the rawness of emotion that you managed to project in your vocal.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. But when I listen to anybody that I listen to, any record that I listen to, unless it's a particular music that's just about beats, It is the voice that you listen to. So if you take your band, you take Spandau Ballet, you take Duran Duran, you take, I don't know, David Bowie, the Stones, whoever you listen to, the first port of call generally is the vocals, because that's the thing that's going to hit you. And if you can connect with the vocal in whatever way, whether you want discord or you want somebody who can't really sing but can express themselves, but there's still the voice that you listen to. If you listen to Bob Dylan, you wouldn't call Bob Dylan the world's best singer, but yeah, when he puts across a song, you believe what he's saying. You know, so I'm very flattered when people say that to me, but I realize that it's not because it's me, it's because it's the voice. And I think that's really important.
I think it's the voice, but it's also your persona was something, because you were very sort of stripped down and like you were saying, raw in the voice, but there was something so honest and straightforward about you, which I think, especially as it was at the time of punk and everything, that made you kind of, you know, we were all looking for kind of truth and reality.
Who was turning you on? Who made you become a writer?
My mom. Well, no, not to become a writer. I was born to do this. So nobody said, Joan, write songs. It's because nobody showed me, like a lot of other people. Nobody showed me, nobody said, Joan, why don't you try writing a song? This is how you write it. This is how you arrange it. Nobody said that. But what happened was when my dad wouldn't let me play his guitar, and didn't even want me to touch it, it made me want to play the guitar. But before that, my mum had bought a piano just as a piece of furniture, put it in the front room, and it literally, as soon as the piano came, I started writing songs. And the piano, as you know, really easy to play, not in an expert way, but it's really easy to play. You could sit on the piano and it makes a great noise. You see Jerry Lee Lewis, he'll sit on the piano, it sounds great. Mm. Elton, different people, they'll sit on the piano.
Yeah, Paul McCartney always talks about, just if you want to begin as a songwriter on the piano, just play the white keys, start with C and just
absolutely
only play the white keys.
Yeah, just put your hand anywhere, you're going to make something sound really nice.
Or do what Brian Ferry does and just play the black keys. Works just as well.
Irving Berlin apparently could only play the black keys, and he had
everything he ever wrote was in B flat
that he could adjust the key with.
Yeah, absolutely. So playing the piano and making up my songs, and I've heard Paul McCartney say this as well. I'm quite good at melodies. I don't have to struggle to get a melody. So when you have the piano and you're just playing really simply, coming up with a melody was not a problem for me. And because I used to read a lot of the classics, you know, Dylan, Dickens, and Shakespeare and Enid Blyton and everybody else, you know, Treasure Island, whatever, Mark Twain. I would read all of those things. And because I was so into the language and how things were expressed, I think the writing just came. And again, I think it was just something that I just had to do. Again, I'm not struggling to do it. But reading those things, I think, helped me to know how to kind of shape words. And then the guitar, as I say, was because my dad wouldn't let me play the guitar. So my mum got me the first guitar by swapping it for the two prams.
She swapped prams for a guitar. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I saw this pram, guitar in a pawn shop. And I said, can I have that? It costs £3. I said, can I have that? She said, we haven't got it, but if they'll swap these two prams for it, you can have it, which I still have the guitar. The guitar has no name, no maker. I can't find out who made it.
What is it? It's an acoustic.
Clumsy guitar, but it's just a cheap old, guitar, but I loved it, still love it. If it wasn't for that guitar, I wouldn't be here now.
Do you still have it?
So yeah, my mom is, still have it. Wow. Yeah, my first album was 1972. At that point, I wasn't listening to guitarists. I was just, when I started writing, I was just writing was it. I wasn't listening to anybody. But once I started, and you get past 72 or 70, and I start to listen, because I didn't, the first album I bought was Free, which would probably be 1970 or something, you know.
Cost off.
Yeah.
Cost off, yeah.
So But then when I heard, then my second thing was Led Zeppelin, and that's Jimmy Page. And I thought Jimmy Page was just fantastic. And then it was Mountain, and I thought Leslie West was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
Then I like Roy Gallagher, and I like Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I like Muddy Waters.
This is a great list. I love this.
Well, yeah, it's a great list. And Mark Knopfler is still my favourite guitarist. I just think he's just, how he plays is just wonderful.
I want to mention this because in 1974, apparently, you were on the front cover of Spare Rib, which was obviously the feminist paper at the time. And you know, people now can't imagine what it was like then. But to be a woman and competing in this world of rock music with such a male dominant. I mean, you know, we deal in rock music as on our show, Rockonteurs, and you know, it's mostly blokes.
Yeah.
And
we don't like at all.
Yeah, but they're the ones who they were wielding the power in that period in the '70s.
Yeah.
And
I always think I'm like the last person to talk about anything to do with music because I haven't got a clue what's going on. I mean, my experience of pop music and the pop music world is very limited. I'm not a I don't mix in the way that you're supposed to.
But did you feel it was harder for you, that you were treated differently because you were a woman at that time?
No, it wasn't. That's what I mean. You see, that's what I'm saying. I didn't find any harder for me part of it. I was just doing what I was doing. So if it was happening without me. I was just writing my songs, playing my songs, getting on with it. The only part that I would say I noticed properly was if I would ask a guitarist, how do you do this? How do you play that particular technique? What's that? And not one of them would tell me. They'd say, they'd say, oh, most men don't even get to that stage. Or in order to show you that, you need to know this. If I show you this bit, you need to know this bit first. Or that's really difficult, but you know, maybe one day you'll get there. So all my playing and my stuff, I'm on my own. No, nobody would show me, and I found that really interesting.
Because you weren't in the gang, as it were. There was a level of condescension.
Yeah,
and mansplaining.
But I could never understand why. Why wouldn't you show me that? It wasn't.
I think guitarists don't like to show anyone anything because they all like to.
Thanks to Joan Arm Trading. And coming up after this, Johnny Marr, Nile Rodgers, and your own Phil Manzanera.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Well, what's this? It's war. And who's first to sign up? It's our own Gary Kemp. Go on, Gary. Show the Bosch what for.
They don't like it up them, do they, these rock stars? Yeah, who have we got on? So it is Johnny. And Johnny obviously has been a long, long friend of yours, hasn't he, Guy? I mean, you go way back, don't you? Where do you go back?
And he's, of course, the man who famously named my favourite bass guitar, Betsy. In fact, he's got an amazing book coming out, Mars Guitars, which is all about his guitar collection. And there's actually a guitar in it that he got off me, which I'm very proud of. But also, he's a huge, huge admirer of yours, Gary. I mean, this is a man, I think, who is the definitive friend of the raconteurs. You know, he's been so supportive.
When I was doing my last solo album, I was sending Johnny tracks. He was so sweet, you know, and giving me advice and different things. And I think we all sort of, he's the sort of head boy, isn't he? In a way, you know, he's the guy that our students of rock want to turn to occasionally for some support. And we listen to everything he has to say. He's always very wise, isn't he? Wise.
He's very, very wise. And he also, for me, one of the sort of defining images of Glastonbury this year was him back to back with Chrissie Hynde. And you just think, that is rock and roll.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shame we weren't there.
That's because we're not rock and roll.
Obviously. Let's get him on, Johnny Marr.
All the Young Dudes was a big one for me. That's how I got my style together, really, from learning records. I wanted to play the whole thing. But everyone had their guitar player. So one mate was into Richie Blackmore. I had a mate who was very, very into Ronson and into Kossoff and all of this. They were listening for the guitar part. But what happened was I was so into pop music, being a little younger, like a teeny bopper, that if the track started with the organ, I was like, oh, what are the chords? I wasn't waiting for the guitar part. I was wanting to play the whole record.
Yeah.
That really developed my style, really. I've got this one-man band kind of thing.
I just want to say that what you just expressed then, Johnny, sums up for me one of your greatest artistic achievements, which is the backing track for How Soon Is Now. You know, I never realized until just recently that there's no keyboard on that at all. It's all only you, you know, from that chugging tremolo, which you can talk about in a second, because I love the story about how you made that and the slide guitar and even that marimba sound, which I thought, oh, that's probably a DX7, you know, but it was you.
That's harmonic. Yeah. I learned this in 2011 when I started to do my solo stuff, that it's helpful to give yourself a narrow, very defined sense of parameters, I think. So the Smiths, we were very provincial. We were very into being Manchester. There was a vibe in mostly coming from Tony Wilson, bless him, as annoying as he was. I say annoying in a very affectionate term, you know.
He was fabulously rude to me, I must say, you know.
But his whole thing was like, you know, we're not London, we're not London, we're not London. And it was helpful, you know. So we had this very provincial bunker mentality, which is helpful. And that we had that later on when we made a couple of other albums. But musically as well, we had this thing of, we're not going to have synths on the record. Now, later, of course, when I discovered the emulator, we conveniently forgot about that. But being forced to do atmospheric noises on the guitar was, that's my point.
Yeah.
It was really helpful. And I remembered that when I came to do my solo stuff, because nowadays, particularly, you know, your option fatigue is a real thing for musicians in the studio.
Yeah, overchoice,
Without sounding like a snob about it, what I actually find is, it's a bit of a crass analogy or comparison, but it's a little bit like a painter having a palette with any color under the sun and just putting it on the canvas.
Yeah.
You get my point. I think having a narrow set of parameters is very helpful, and that really helped me out in the Smiths. I was forced to, if I wanted to hear some noises or whatever, I was forced to do it on the guitar. And then I quite quickly realized that that was a bit of a good politic. Great. We always start with the guitar, no matter what. Except maybe one track started with drums, but yeah. So that
That's interesting. That's an interesting thing to know. I'll go back and check that.
You have your manifesto. And as I've got older, it might sound incredibly obvious, but with my own band, until I start changing, there are things now where it does sound obvious, but if I can do it on a guitar, I feel duty bound to do it on a guitar.
Mm-mm-mm.
We're a guitar band. There's loads of other kinds of bands.
Johnny, if you don't mind, I'm sure you had loads of bands before you met Morrissey. But the big one for everyone is that meeting between you and him and how it was. You know, I just want to just have a listen to that story.
Well, I've been hustling around for years. I've joined a band of...
You say for years. I mean, how old are you at this point?
I left school at 15 to be in a band because the band I was in at the time, my mate's band, we were pretty competent, like a kind of power pop band. And we went and did a demo at Nick Lowe's house, home studio, and which was amazing.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So then
we had him on the show. He was amazing. He was amazing. Right.
So, of course, Andy Rourke, who's my mate, and myself, we went back to our school then and just said to everybody, like, you know, the next week, we were just like, hey, guess what? We're leaving, suckers. Yeah. Well, yeah, see, well, you will if you're watching Top of the Pops in a few weeks.
We've all done that.
Yeah. I didn't even notice that we'd left. But anyway, so and then I've been in a few different bands, and I was in one band, a band of adults. I kind of got headhunted, this band of real reprobates, but they'd made a record. They were called Sister Ray, and they were on this compilation album. They sounded a bit like Stooges mixed with Hawkwind. That's really, Anyway, I've been in a few bands like that, and I got to this point where I kind of knew what band I really, in my dreams, the kind of band I really wanted. And I was working in this clothes shop, and everybody used to come in and out of this clothes shop, and people from Factory Records. So I knew all the bands there. You know, I'm 17, maybe 18. And I got very into the girl groups. I got into the girl groups because I was into the Dolls. And like all of us, you know, I know you would have done in a big way, like everyone did with Bowie. Our heroes inform our taste. I got educated through the music papers and turning me onto a lot of things. That's how I found out about William Burroughs, and we all did through Bowie and stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was very into the New York scene. I loved Patti Smith and I loved the Dolls. All those people used to do covers of Be My Baby, Ronettes and the Crystals and the Shangri-Las. So those songs I liked them more than modern music. I liked old records more. I just thought they were more interesting and weirder. They didn't sound...
There was a massive 50s revival then, wasn't there? I mean, it was the American Graffiti and obviously, you know, Grease and whatever. But it was a popular thing, you know, the revival of 50s. A kitsch, in a kitsch way.
Also because punk styling was very 50s, wasn't it?
With every, the quiff.
Yeah.
It didn't sound... Keeps to me, and I mean, particularly the mid early 60s stuff from the Brill Building, like the Crystals and particularly the Shangri-Las. I love that, so I was very into that. And I lived in this attic space with this family. I moved out my mum and dad's, got this job in a clothes shop, and I was living in this little attic space. I had my own little, I treated it like a sort of laboratory in a way. I had a little three track, weirdly, cassette recorder. And I had this idea, because I love the girl groups, of, well, everyone in around the factory scene was very informed by electro and hip-hop and New York, because there was a lot of that. The bands were going over ACR, New Order. There was a sort of transatlantic thing happening. All my mates were being funky, so I knew all of that. And it was interesting in it, but I thought, well, I'm onto something with these kind of chord changes, these... And then it expanded then to Motown, which I'd always loved. So I started playing these kind of chord changes and writing these songs in my bedroom. And I thought, well, you also want to be modern. So I didn't want to, it wasn't like I wanted to form a band that dressed that way. It wasn't like I wanted to be the Commitments. But I had this weird kind of lateral thinking where I thought, if we had the back line of Patti Smith and I learned how to arrange these songs, these short, weird songs, it would be more interesting than what my pals were doing, because they were very into James Brown, Certain Ratio, were doing a lot of that. There was a bit of a jazz thing going on. And I just thought, well, I'm a rock musician. I wanted to make a new kind of rock band. And in an ideal world, it would be a four-piece. And I'd have a sort of my own kind of Mick Jagger, because I was obsessed with the Rolling Stones, which is why the first Smith single, 45, is Navy Blue. It looks like a Decca record. Now, I'd already knew of Stephen Morrissey, because some of my mates had been in a band with him years before, and he seemed to have dropped off the radar. But he was someone who I knew was in my town, who was regarded himself as a frontman, a singer, even though, as I say, he'd gone quiet for a few years. But more importantly, I knew that he was into the girl groups because he was a Dolls fan. That was the only other person on the planet would understand what I was going for. And he was a singer, and I needed a singer. And that all turned out to be true. He was the only other person who knew about the Crystals and the Angels and the Cookies and all of that. So the next day, I did a bit of phoning around my old neighborhood, a bit of the older guys, because Morrissey was four or five years older than me. And one guy gave me a number of another guy, and I went and knocked on the door. Anyway, I got his address from someone who used to know him, and I jumped on the bus with a friend of mine, and I went up the path and knocked on his door. His sister came at the door and we said, "He's Stephen in," and then he appeared at the door, and I just went a mile a minute. I formed this band. So we went up the stairs. My mate then just became completely mute, and I think he was like, this is history in the making. Because I probably told him that on the bus. I went upstairs in his room, you know, very tidy young man's bedroom, and he said to me, do you want to put a record on? I went over and I looked through his records. He had some 45s, some Sandy Shaw stuff, which was interesting to me. I was a big, big Dusty Springfield fan. And then I just found this Marvelettes record called Paperboy, and I went to put it on, and he said, good choice. And I flipped over the B-side, which was called You're the One, and I just put the B-side on.
Mate, oh my God, that's a great story. He got you then, he knew you're the one.
And me and him just went, let's be brilliant. Let's be amazing.
I love the origin stories, don't you?
Yeah.
And I mean, that was a particularly good one, you know, those sliding doors of it could have happened, it may not have happened, you know, those meetings, those that turning over of the record, you know, that. I mean, where did I meet you? I wish I could have slid back and avoided that one.
You could have quite easily, actually, in Budapest. Back. All you had to do was not go to the bar.
Right. But that wasn't going to happen, was it? So, it's what, you know, what Johnny was saying about, you know, all his mates were getting funky.
I mean, when we say that Nile Rodgers was one of Johnny's guitar heroes, I mean, he named his son yes. Nile.
It's interesting, you know, how, you know, one thing leads to another. And of course, what I found fascinating when we spoke to Nile Rodgers, we were doing his origin story of Chic, is I couldn't believe where that came from.
Yeah, exactly. Because we're back home again, aren't we? To Roxy Music.
Yeah, I know, but to British glam rock. You know, Roxy were never the biggest band in America, and for them to be a direct influence...
Well, it's only because Nile was over here, wasn't it? It's only because he was at Wembley.
Oh, right, okay. So he got on a plane.
He got on a plane. Well, he got dragged along to see them. But also, I just love that quote of Johnny's about Brian. It said, some people collect guitars, Brian collects guitarists. And what blows my mind is actually getting confirmed, and actually even better than I'd heard it, the story of how Nile and Bernard were introduced.
Let's hear it.
I've got to hear this from the horse, so to speak, right? The story around it is that when you first spoke to Nard, right, this is Bernard Edwards, by the way, listeners. Apparently, now, this story I know is your aunt, I think it was, worked at the next booth from him at the post office and told her...
Close. It was my girlfriend's mom.
There you go. But the story is, the story I heard, right, and I'd love to think this is true, is that apparently the first time you spoke to each other on the phone and you were telling him all your ideas about Hendrix and Indian music and orchestral and stuff and everything, and he said, brother, can you do a brother a favor? Lose my number.
Yeah, it actually was, it was shorter than that. It was shorter than that. It had no brother in it. The exact quote was, yo, my man, lose my number. Click, hung up the phone on me. Now remember, we
and how worlds collide, man. That could have changed the shape of music.
But it wound up working out perfectly. But let me give you the backstory on this. So my girlfriend's mom worked at the post office right next to Bernard, and she never heard him play a note. She just said, "There's something," you know. So my girlfriend's mom, she was married to a famous jazz bass player, an upright bass player, and somehow she says, "I don't know, this cat next to me, he's just got a vibe. I don't know. It's like there's something about him." So she told him. She says, "You should meet my daughter's boyfriend. You know, he's really cool. Blah blah blah." So he called me up, and in those days when we put bands together, we had a newspaper in New York called the Village Voice.
Yeah.
And we were just trying to get the most well-rounded players we could find. So you would always put an ad, we'd call them strip ads, and you would say, looking for bass player to play funk, jazz, prog rock, blah blah blah, you know, whatever it was.
Not on heavy trip.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, right. No heavy trippers need apply. So she gave Bernard my phone number and he called the house, and I was really into my hippie head. All of the people who lived in the apartment with us were like deadheads, and you know, and my God. So one dude, my girlfriend's mom's boyfriend, he was a total Frank Zappa fanatic. So he was a Zappa fanatic. My boy Lonnie was a deadhead. And remember, we're all black and Latino, right? So he was a deadhead. And I was like totally into Jimmy. But I also liked, I was a huge fan of Traffic and you know, Country Joe and the Fish and all sorts of really hip jam bands. And I love surf bands. So when Bernard called, he says, so my man, I hear you looking for a bass player. You trying to put a band together? And I went total hippie on him. I said, yeah, man, you know, like I wanted to be a cross between like Fairport Convention and a little Mahavishnu, you know, like some Country Joe and the Fish, man, you know, and Bernard just listened to me go on and on with this sort of like hippie diatribe. And then this is all he said, yo, my man, lose my number, and hung the phone right up on my click. So I called Bernard up and I said, man, we got to do the black version of this. And he was like, what? And I ran out. I went down to Camden Lock, where you could get all the albums really cheap in those days. And I didn't realize Roxy Music had three albums already. And I was like, whoa.
I love this. I
never even heard of these dudes. And they got three albums. And they had like Amanda Lear on the cover and like Playboy bunnies. And we were like, whoa, what's up with this?
Well, you lifted the album cover, didn't you?
Right. So if you look at the
first... This would be Country Life or something like that.
Yeah, so you look at the first Chic album cover and we, you know, we did the whole supermodel thing and... So it was like,
and they're doing all the kind of 1920s style, aren't
right,
they?
Right, exactly.
You know, it's got this kind of look to it.
Yeah, so we got all into it, and so we did the black version of Roxy Music. But while we were putting the band together, because Tony Thompson wasn't in the original Big Apple band, so basically it was just Bernard and myself and a singer named Bobby Cotter. Bobby had just finished a stint with Jesus Christ Superstar, so he could really sing. He played Judas, and he could just blow.
Oh, that's the highest song in the show, yeah.
Yeah. So we did a bunch of songs that only myself and Bobby did a little writing. Bernard hadn't written anything with me yet. So we took all those demos around, and every record company loved our demos. They all wanted to see us, and when we showed up and we were a black rock and roll band, they turned us down right away. They said, hey, you guys don't look like your music. We were like, what do you mean we don't look like our music? And we finally got what they meant. Bobby, on one of our rock and roll gigs, he met a girl that became his wife, so he left the band. So now it was just Bernard and myself. So I still had the Roxy Music thing in my head. And I said, you know, we got to do the black version of this. So we started hunting for musicians. It was like the Magnificent Seven. We were going around looking and looking and looking. And the first person we hired was a keyboard player named Rob Sabino, who played on every single Chic record to this very day.
Yeah. Amazing.
So we hired Rob Sabino. And he said, man, you know what, man? You should see these friends of mine. They're called KISS. And, you know, let's go check them out, man. You know, my good friend is Ace Frehley. So we went to check out KISS at a club in New York called the Hotel Diplomat at the place called Le Jardin de Paris. And we went to
check. You're making this up now. These names are just too good.
No. Serious. Straight up.
It's like a Simon Templar Saint episode.
No. Totally straight up. So we go and we check out KISS. And everybody is flipping out over them. They're like screaming. Ah, ah, ah. But then they take off their makeup and not one person recognizes them. So Ace comes and sits at the table with me and we're drinking and laughing. And like, I'm going, wait a minute. Everybody was just like losing their complete shit over you. And now you're sitting here with me completely anonymous. And that was
And you're not getting laid.
I'll tell you a funny story about Ace and that later on. But yeah. So I was like, this is amazing. You could be like rock stars. And then when you take off your makeup, nobody has any idea who you are. So the concept of Chic was a cross between the fashion and the coolness of Roxy Music and the anonymity of KISS. And then we put our name in all uppercase letters. I'm actually looking at our first thing right now. It's right next to me.
Yep.
All uppercase letters. So we had two C's, an H, and an I. Kiss had a K, two S's, and an I. Oh. We were like, yo. Oh.
Whose was the name? Who came up with the name?
Bernard actually came up with the name because I still wanted to keep the Big Apple Band because we had a following. Why would we change our name? And the only reason why we changed our name was because a guy who I went to school with, a guy named Walter Murphy, put out a disco record called A Fifth of Beethoven. And he called himself Walter Murphy and the Big Apple Band. So everybody thought that was us.
Chic is very like Roxy music as well. But you know what's interesting is this sort of circular thing between going on between UK and America. So we had John Taylor on the show a few weeks ago, and you know I was in Spandau Ballet, he was in Duran Duran. You know, we kind of had the same. We burst out into the onto the scene in 1980, and what we said every time was, "We're our music. What makes the 80s music? It's a combination of the Sex Pistols, glam rock, and Chic." So what I didn't quite fully understand is that Chic's inspiration came from glam rock. It came from Roxy music as well. And of course, then you as a person end up coming in the 80s, end up coming back into the UK and redesigning our greatest glam rock star, David Bowie, and Duran Duran.
Right, exactly. And it's funny.
You just keep giving that gift, don't you?
The longest relationship I've ever had. Well, now it's now Diana Ross. I'm working with her now. But the longest relationship I've ever had with any artist has been Duran Duran and Bryan Ferry. I've worked with them more and longer than anyone in my life.
So Roxy Music and Bryan Ferry are all ringing in our ears now, and which seamlessly takes us to our final guitar hero. I wore the fly glasses. I went to Phil Manzanera's house a couple of years ago for a cup of tea, and those famous fly glasses was just sort of, which I think, who designed them? Anthony Price. He made them, and you know, which he wears, you know, on, I think, on the For Your Pleasure cover, or is it the first album? I can't remember.
It's on the inside of the second one. Yeah,
yeah, For Your Pleasure. And I put those on. I mean, that was a big moment for me, Guy.
Yeah, you fell down the stairs, didn't you?
But I was still buzzing. Anyway, he's an old mate of yours, isn't he?
Phil, yeah, well, he's collaborated, of course, with Pink Floyd, Robert Wyatt, David Byrne, The Pretenders.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years, been doing this fantastic project with Tim Finn, which I might have been on.
Yeah, yeah.
Always best known, of course, for his bass in Roxy Music. And should say he was one of that original bunch of mates that we called up who made Rock on Tours possible.
He was.
So I think eternally grateful.
Is this like the second episode we ever did?
Yeah.
Interesting. Let's go back in time. To Phil Manzanera.
Nice to be here.
So I'm
your smiling faces.
I know you well, but I'm still thrilled that I know the bloke from Roxy Music, and that wonderful inside sleeve from the album picture that had you with the fly glasses
with
on
the bug eyes,
and the famous Hagstrom Firebird.
I had the Firebird.
Where did all those guitars come from?
I think the Hagstrom could have been Paul's, I can't remember, bizarrely.
Paul Thompson.
The drummer.
What would he be doing?
Well, I can't remember. I have to Google it to find out who owned what. Obviously, Eno's Snake guitar was his own Snake guitar, you know, which is about a tenor from somewhere in Shepherd's Bush. And the Les Paul was the John Porter's Les Paul, who bass player, that I borrowed on a lot of, to use on a lot of the albums. Yeah.
And where did the Firebird come from? How did you find it?
The guy who designed it, Ray Dietrich, when Gibson were looking at the Fender Success and they wanted to compete, so they commissioned Ray Dietrich, who was a famous car designer who had built all those amazing Fins.
Not the Cadillacs.
The great Chevys.
It has a deco look to it, doesn't it?
And so he basically took one of those fins, if you can imagine, from and worked it up into the Firebird. And back in the day, when the Melody Maker, which was one of the two music newspapers in the 60s, they had an ad section at the back. and people used to buy and sell guitars in there. And I saw one day it said Firebird guitar. I had no idea what a Firebird guitar was. And so I rang up and said, you know, that sounds good. Can I come around? I went to this amazing house in Regent's Park, and it was the son of a very rich American guys who'd come over from Kalamazoo. And they had bought their young son a red Gibson Firemates direct from the factory, custom made, because most of them are brown. And he opened the door and he just like held the red Firemates. I said, oh, yeah, that's mine. Thank you. And the reason was I had bought a Hofner Galaxy, which was red. That's all I could afford in the early 60s. And so red guitar, and I thought something flashy, you know, for Roxy. But, you know, when I joined Roxy, actually, they wanted me to ditch my 335 and get a white Strat. So for the first album...
Who demanded that?
You know, their style icons, you know, who were running the band.
Well, that's funny, because back then, white Strat, I suppose, would be Hendrix. But otherwise, you think white Fenders, you kind of think the Beach Boys.
But it wasn't sort of Anthony Price who decided what guitar people had.
Probably, you know, he gave me the glass, he gave me the look, you know, so he probably did decide. But I thought it was a bit dull, you know, so... I eventually got my red Firebird, and that's been my signature guitar, if you like.
It is your signature, yes.
Yeah. And I had gone for an audition with Roxy and failed.
Wow.
And they got... But I made friends with them. I used to bump into them all over the place. And then...
When you say all over the place, go on. What were the hangs in those days?
Well, at avant-garde concerts at the QEH, you know, like...
What, sort of Stockhausen?
Not Stockhausen, but Terry Riley all those kind of things. I'd bump into Eno and...
songs just in C.
Yes, in C was very popular then, yeah, and Rainbow and Curved Air.
Yeah.
And that album. And some friends of mine... did the light show for them. They got a gig at the Friends of the Tate Christmas party. So I went along with my friend to see the light show, and this tranny pulled up. Actually, I've got to say...
Transit van.
Because no, it could have been a tranny if it had been a year later.
I thought it was Eno.
Yeah. Well, so it turned up, and Brian was driving it, and Andy
Brian
was
driving a transit van.
And Andy was
that's
in the front seat, and Paul was stuffed in there somewhere, and Eno, because being sort of not so tall, was sort of slotted in with the PA system in the back, and they and Dave O'List was there, who was by then a guitarist, and he was a fantastic guitarist who was in, and probably still is, in the band called The Nice, who you know had done. Very well.
Which just started with Keith Emerson. Yeah. Five Bridges was the sort of first folk rock.
And anyway, the doors opened and they all were humping these Turner cabinets in. And I thought, wow, they don't have roadies. and poor chaps are having to bring the stuff in. So I was sort of about to help. And I noticed that Dave wasn't helping because he'd been in a professional band before and he was just sitting there with a fag and watching them, you know.
Watching Brian Ferry.
The gear in and everything. And so made contact again, you know, saying, would you come down and help mix the sound? Because in those days, Eno used to be in the audience mixing the sound.
Yeah.
Because he was a bit...
With a VS synthesizer or...?
With his synthesizer and the mixing desk. And I don't think they allowed him on stage because he made everyone too nervous. So, and also there was, moving on. And we haven't got all day here. And
because they didn't want to get poked in the eye with an ostrich feather.
It was pre all that gear. So I went round to this friend of theirs' house, which was sort of a derelict house, but had some electricity in Notting Hill. And when I turned up, they said, oh, Dave hasn't turned up. His guitar's there. Fancy having a go. But I had a sort of little premonition that something might be coming up. So I had learnt all this stuff the night before because they'd done a John Peel show. I could hear, you know, what the songs were. I said, well, look, show me the chords or whatever. Thinking back on it now, there are only like two or three chords. And show me the chords and I'll play it. So I play it and I'll just play it like just totally right. And they said, well, okay, next one. So, you know, they thought, Jesus, this guy actually is bloody good.
Were you imposing a style? Did you have a style of guitar playing?
No, I was actually sort of like copying a bit what they'd played already. So I knew, you know, I didn't want to scare the horses, as they say. So so I played that. And then they said, well, would you like to join? And so I joined on the... it was my birthday on the 31st of January. The 4th of February I joined, and the contract, Roxy contract, is signed on the 14th of February. And then 6 weeks later in the studio recording, and then 8 weeks later it was number four in the chart. 1972. So I just was in the right place at the right time. But how lucky were they?
And the look. And all played together. The glam look. I mean, because you toured with Bowie, didn't you? Bowie at the Rainbow, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we only played with him about twice or three times, but he was incredibly supportive and nice. And, you know, when I remember at rehearsals, Andy and Brian had been to see him, and I think that influenced a lot that we had to step up our game in terms of presentation. And in fact, we then got his lighting guy. And in those days, he was the first person to have these sort of scaffolding things on small stages with some actual theatre lights. And people didn't have that before. So
he had Mick Ronson up on a gantry somewhere, didn't he, on some scaffolding. The band were sort of...
That's right. So and we had his guy. We used his guy. And so, you know, all those kind of cumulative things helped. And obviously then we upped our game with... we're all a bit shy. So we said, let's just put on costumes as if you're in the theatre or something like that and become different people when you go on stage. So, you know, you turn up with sort of drab clothes and then suddenly in the dressing room. But it wasn't coordinated or anything like that. It was totally... Everybody did their own thing, found their own people. And the first time we saw what we were each wearing was when we literally changed before going on stage. Really? And they said, you're not going to wear... What is that? You're wearing that? You know, or something.
Did you ever both be wearing the same? I can't go on stage. He's wearing the same snakeskin.
Never.
Anthony Price then came along, didn't he? And coordinated it.
Well, Wendy Dagworthy as well. You know, in those early days, because all the outfits on the second album cover were Wendy Dagworthy. Well, actually, no, mine, Brian's. Enos was done by Carol McNichol.
You talk about the centerfold.
Yeah, the centerfold. Yeah.
For your pleasure.
So it was, you know, a variation of lots of people making stuff. And it was just the juxtaposition of it all together that created a whole. And it's the same with the music. You know, it's everyone playing little bits and little bubbles coming. You know, the bubble coming out of my head was, I'm in the Velvet Underground and the early Pink Floyd. I'm playing this way. And I don't, whatever you're playing over there, this is what I'm playing.
Right. You know, this is almost like Eno's Cards. Isn't
it? Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
The Bleak Strategy. It's like you drew the Pink Floyd one or whatever.
Well, the psychedelic 60s and Soft Machine and all that fuzzed up stuff.
Thank you for listening to our first sort of summer greatest hits while Guy and I lounge around in Eastbourne. And of course, also prepare for our first trip of Nick Mason's Source for the Secrets to Australia. In fact, we might be there as you are listening to this. And I think in saying that, Guy, I'm hoping on getting Hank Marvin down to the Perth show.
Where yes!
Another old raconteur.
Exactly.
He should have been on this episode. Why wasn't Hank? I'm sorry you're not on this episode, but of course you are the guitar god to nearly every guitar god that we've had on. Isn't that true, Guy?
That he is the guitar god's guitar god. Kind of, it goes Hank Marvin and Jeff Beck in terms of guitar gods, doesn't it? But he might be turning up on our next collection.
He may, because he is...
We're doing Legends of the 60s.
We are. And we've had a few of those on. I'm sure it's going to be another chance for us to meet on the sun deck at the splendid hotel we're staying at in Eastbourne, looking down on the sea mist and the scones.
Exactly, before repairing to the Alhambra for the evening's performance of Rum for Your Wife.
Yes. Oh, I think I just burped up a whelk.
Anyway, there you have it. Don't forget you can listen to all these interviews in their entirety wherever you get your podcasts from.
And thank you to Ian Callaghan for putting this special together and the polishing.
So it's good night from me.
And it's good night from him.
Rock Haunters is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.